This time introduce themselves, starting with my Honorable Vice Chair, Charles Starr.
Senator Charles Starr, representing District 13, parts of four counties from Sherwood to Kaiser, Newburg in Hill County, Wilsonville in Clackamas County, and pleasure to be here.
To this side. Hi, Senator Vicki Walker from Eugene. I'm on the left side, which some of you may think that suits my personality, but I've been on the right side all the time last session, so I'm going to have to get used to being on this side. I'm, as I said, from Eugene. I've been on judiciary since, I've been in the legislature since 1999. I'm a court reporter in my real life, so I've listened to more lawyers than most of you, probably. I can tell the good ones from the bad ones. But I like this committee. It's a lot of fun, and we do a lot of work. So look forward to this session.
I'm Senator Doug Whitsett. I'm from Klamath Falls, Senate District 28. Takes in all of Klamath, Lake, Crook, parts of Jackson, and Deschutes counties. I'm a retired veterinarian, small farm owner. Have some residential real estate property. 35 years in small business, and I'm happy to be here too.
Senator Floyd Przanski, Senate District 4, that includes parts of Lane and Douglas County, since I'm on your left, our right. Nice to be here today.
Our other two committee members are Charlie Ringo from the Beaverton, Northwest Portland area, and Roger Beyer from Malala. And in addition to the committee, we are very fortunate to have excellent committee staff and counsel this session. Joe O'Leary, right here, was in private practice in Portland, where he specialized in white-collar criminal defense work. Heidi Moad, who is another member, another counsel person in the judiciary office, worked for the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and is an experienced prosecutor. She's also the daughter of Representative Jeff Barker, who is on House Judiciary. Heidi is the latest in a long line of excellent committee counsel that Mike Schrunk has volunteered for our process here. Sam Sears will be joining us on January 19th. He's currently on his honeymoon. He's at the beginning of his law practice. He recently clerked for the Oregon Court of Appeals and last session was an extern with the House Judiciary Committee. And, of course, you all know Bill Taylor, our veteran Red Sox fan, who is starting his 10th legislative session, and we are so happy to have you back, Bill.
Thank you.
Heidi Moad will be spending most of the early part of the session working with the House Judiciary Criminal Law Subcommittee. So we'll see more of her over here when the House bills make their way to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Joe will staff most of the Senate Criminal Law and Dependency Law bills. Sam Sears and Bill Taylor will split up civil law, domestic relations law, and support enforcement law bills in both the House and the Senate Judiciary Committees. As you all know, members of the committee, the council is here to assist both of the Senate Judiciary Committee and you. Needless to say, they will be extremely busy, but please feel free to request their assistance, but do understand that they must give priority to committee work. Also, they will need to keep me as chair apprised of what they are doing. If you feel more comfortable maintaining confidentiality, then it would be best if you or your staff work directly with legislative counsel. Finally, staff is more than willing to assist you on the floor when you are carrying a committee bill. I've taken advantage of this many times and recommend it. Please let them know if you need their assistance. Otherwise, they will assume their assistance is not needed on the floor. So you have to plan in advance. In addition to the councils on our committee, we have Patsy Wood, who's over there, and Dale Penn Jr. is a familiar name in our process. And yes, he is Dale Penn's son. Elizabeth Howe and Luann Remig, who are all in the judiciary office waiting to help at any time. So with that, we will move into a work session for possible measure introduction. Mr. O'Leary.
LC-1264, relating to concealed weapons on school property, sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary. LC-174, relating to independent medical examinations, sponsored by Committee on the Judiciary. LC-175, relating to personal injury protection benefits, sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary. LC-888, relating to wrongful sterilization, sponsored by Committee on the Judiciary. LC-1204, relating to minimum amounts required for motor vehicle liability insurance, sponsored by Committee on the Judiciary. LC-1298, relating to independent medical examination, sponsored by Committee on the Judiciary. LC-1438, relating to attorney fees for tort claims of specified amount, sponsored by Committee on the Judiciary. LC-1474, relating to physician-patient privilege, sponsored by Committee on the Judiciary. LC-1476, relating to court reporting, sponsored by Committee on the Judiciary. LC-1480, relating to transcript fees, sponsored by Committee on the Judiciary. And finally, LC-1653, relating to programs established by the Board of Medical Examiners for the State of Oregon for certain medical professionals, and sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary.
Thank you. Committee members, as we did in the interim, the Judiciary Committee introduces bills as a courtesy for members. This vote in favor of introducing this bill is not a vote in favor of the bill itself. And so with that, I have a question. If Senator Starr were to make a motion, does he have to list all the numbers? Or can he just list the aforementioned?
Madam Chair, if I could just interject. LC-1653, we're going to have the ready clause redrawn. So that'll be one piece of the whole time. I'm sorry not to get to that early, but after the Senate session, I will have the Legislative Council.
Okay, well, we'll have the motion not include that LC-1653. Senator Stark.
Madam Chair, I believe proper that we call ourselves into work session before we proceed.
I did.
You did that,
yeah.
And I was out to lunch. thank you, Madam Chair.
You stayed right here next to me the whole time.
All right. I move that we accept, as committee bills, introduce those bills read to us by committee counsel in block as committee bills.
With the exception of LC-1653, Senator Stark.
With the exception of LC-1653.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved that the LCs listed by Council O'Leary be introduced as a committee bill with the exception of LC-1653. Is there a discussion on the motion? Okay.
Madam Chair, I just think we're going to have some fun.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I agree. Those of the opinion the aforementioned LC should be introduced as committee bills will vote aye, and those opposed, no. We'll start with a roll call vote this time.
Senator Beyer,
excused.
Senator Prozanski.
Aye.
Senator Ringo.
Aye.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Senator Whitsett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr.
Aye.
Chair Burdick.
Aye.
Motion carries, and the aforementioned LCs will be introduced as committee bills. Now we return to our previous item of business. We're out of work session, and we will now take up the committee rules, which I skipped past the first time around. So, Council Taylor, maybe you could give us the highlights of the committee rules.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think, first off, the big change from the last section is in Section 5, and this is accordance with
SRE.
Section 1, public notice must be given 48 hours in advance of a meeting. Last year it was 24 hours notice. And then it sets forth when, in the event the committee does not complete the scheduled agenda, items may be carried over to the next scheduled meeting with the following guidelines, an emphasis on guidelines. The measure has been initially scheduled with a 48-hour notice. The measure must be carried over for the same type of meeting. The chair announces in committee her intent to schedule a measure at the next meeting. A revised agenda listing the measures that originally received 48-hour notice shall be posted as soon as possible following the adjournment of the committee meeting. The other one, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, measures introduced by the committee at the request of an organization or person other than a member of the committee shall indicate the person or organization interested in the measure by stating that the measure is introduced by the committee at the request of.
Thank you for that summary. Is there any, was there a motion?
I move approval of the committee rules.
Senator Starr
has moved approval of the committee rules. Is there any discussion? Okay, without that, are there any objections? Rules are approved. Now comes the good part of our agenda here today, the introduction to Oregon's judicial branch and the state court system. And I would like to turn it over at this point to our Honorable Chief Justice Wallace P. Carson, Jr., from the Oregon Supreme Court. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I hate that, but that's necessary. I am Wally Carson, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. And I'm very pleased to be here, and thank you for providing us the opportunity to give you a brief review of the court. I know most of you, either through service here or working in the court systems, are familiar with what we do, and we'll try to be brief. As I say, when I go on the circuit, not the circuit court, but out on the speech circuit. My wife and I have raised three children, so I'm quite accustomed to being interrupted without completing a full thought. So we encourage you to stop me, and ask a question or have us amplify or shorten, as the case may be, and we'll try to respond to your interests. I have just a little bit of order. I think you all have the orientation materials that reference will be made to as we go through here. Tab 1 is the kind of the wiring diagram. The first page just shows you how you have set up the court system. The only court system in the Constitution is the Supreme Court, and then as the legislature will provide or is provided by law. And you can see over the past the courts have been established, and you'll hear from some representatives of those courts in just a little bit. Behind that is some key numbers for and individuals that will be able to help you, and if you have any questions about the judicial branch or judicial department, we'd be pleased to respond. If you can't find the right person, call me, and my number's there, and I'll try to get you an answer. And then we have a list of the appellate court judges. We have then, following that, the judicial districts. We have 27. You have established, at our request, 27 judicial districts for the circuit court. And Judge Rasmussen will talk to that when he comes up here, and also has a list of the judges and the trial court administrators from the various counties and districts, I should say. And I would encourage you to become acquainted. My hope is, and I've asked TCAs and presiding judges to become acquainted with you. That's our responsibility. But if you have a question and you want to know how it's playing out in Peoria, then you're most welcome to call the presiding judge or a lawyer or the trial court administrator. With that, I think that I will move to a more interesting part of the program for me as well, and that is I want to introduce Associate Justice W. Michael Gillette. Michael was born in Seattle but raised in downtown Milton Freewater, and has legislative experience from the other side, from this side, as Solicitor General for the Attorney General's Office for a number of years. He was then appointed in August of 1977 to go on the Court of Appeals, and in February of 1986 was appointed to fill Justice Betty Roberts' position on the Oregon Supreme Court, and he has been a very capable judge on our court since then. And he's the second most senior member of the court. And with that, with your permission, Madam Chair, I'll turn the rest over to Justice-elect.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. We're glad to have you.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. Members of the committee, as the Chief Justice indicated, my name is W. Michael Gillette, or for most of you who know me by now, it's Mick. And I hope we could do business on that basis. It is a privilege to appear again before this committee. I have had the opportunity a few times in the past to appear before you, usually in a consultative basis. As you are aware, it's not the practice of members of the judiciary in general to appear with respect to measures that are pending because we may be called upon later to deal with them in litigation. But you have been kind enough to ask me to drop by once in a while when some issue of constitutional or administrative law arose and you thought perhaps just an overview would be helpful. The Chief Justice has asked if I would be willing today to make a presentation that is somewhat akin to the presentation I made to the House Judiciary Committee 2 years ago, a copy of which appears in your materials behind the tab one. And Senator Burdick, members of the committee, one of the reasons I became an appellate lawyer so that I could just argue appeals was so that I would not have to read transcripts of my own statements anymore.
They're verbatim, aren't they?
Senator Walker will particularly appreciate that her job when she's working as a court reporter is to take down whatever in our foolishness we say, and of course later then when we read the transcript and we recall how brilliant we were in making a presentation, we examine that brilliance and discover that it's hidden under a pile of dross. And I have to tell you that the materials that are before you are a verbatim transcript of what I said to the House Judiciary Committee. I hope there's some stuff in there that's really worthwhile. I do have to tell you, however, that it's verbatim, and that's its problem. You also are going to be stuck with another verbatim presentation, but between the two, perhaps there will be some things of some use to you. You will hear from other members of the court system today about the way the Oregon court system is organized, and I'm not going to presume to talk about that. I want to talk about something that is more fundamental and something that gives rise, I think, occasionally to friction between your branch, or as the Constitution refers to it, Department of Government, and our Department of Government. The idea of what it is the judiciary does with respect to legislation, more specifically the idea of an independent judiciary and the responsibility of an independent judiciary in a constitutional government. And I can't talk about that without first touching upon the idea of a constitution, period, because it is the source from which the judicial power flows, and it contains within it, at least by implication, an explanation of what it is the judicial power is supposed to consist of. Societies from the time they began to organize at all were organized around, first of all, around the idea of protection and power. Societies were designed to help groups of people protect themselves from marauding outsiders. That's what societies were for. As societies became more complex, it wasn't possible to organize around a single individual who was the toughest guy in the neighborhood. They began to organize around the single individual who could get the other tough guys in the neighborhood to go along with him or her, and it was usually to go along with him. The process developed over literally thousands of years to the point at which significant governmental authority was organized around a central figure, most commonly referred to as a king, who was supported by a group of lesser but important individuals in our Anglo-American system, lords, who were responsible through their vassals for preparing armies to enforce the king's will on those who weren't willing to listen. The king was responsible also for deciding disputes between individuals. And for a while that worked fine, as long as there weren't too many individuals for the king to listen to. But obviously, the time is referred to in biblical terms in the book of Judges. The time came when the king really didn't have the time anymore to do that work personally. And by the time the Anglo-American system, really the English system first, had developed in the 15th and 16th centuries, you had the king handing out that responsibility to his designated judges, to people who would perform that function for the king. And those individuals went out, because the king no longer had the time to, those individuals went out to parts of the kingdom and sat and heard disputes between individuals and adjudged those arguments in the king's name. That is why in our system we refer to the place you go to get a dispute adjudged as a court. Because from the English system, that's what that meeting of the assizes was called. It was the court. It was an extension of the king's power, and therefore an extension of the court itself. The American system absorbed a great deal of what the British had done in this respect. A great deal it was good, and some it was pretty silly. But in the main, I think we picked up the better parts and ignored some of the worst parts. The key, however, was that it was recognized that the function of a judge in general, was to decide a dispute between two individuals according to set or fixed principles of law. There had to be some rule that existed outside of these two people to which the judge would look to decide which of these two people was correct and which was not. The difficulty with the English system was that every time the fixed principle to which the judge looked offended first the king and later on, as the English government developed, offended Parliament, they changed the rules. This, of course, became particularly offensive to the colonists in the New World, who discovered that the rules kept getting changed all the time, and they were always the loser with respect to the rules. So the individuals in the colonies in America became more and more convinced that one of the keys to a free society was a society whose, quote, fixed, close quote, rules didn't get changed quite so readily, and a society whose fixed rules were not subject to the whim of either the monarch or, more accurately, the Parliament, although they like to blame the king. He was just easy to shoot at, but the fact is it was the Parliament that was responsible. And they wanted something that was a little more fixed and reliable. They first petitioned the king for permission to set up governments of their own, which included independent judiciaries. The king would not permit it, and the king kept sending judges instead to the colonists with instructions as to how they were to decide what was going on. This led, along with a lot of other small disagreements, to something that was mentioned in all the papers at the time called the Revolutionary War. And the Revolutionary War was preceded by a Declaration of Independence, which is famous for the way it begins, when in the course of human events, etc. Thomas Jefferson was a very good writer for a lawyer. But it includes a bill of particulars as to those things which the colonists were particularly upset about. And a couple of them seem worth mentioning, at least in passing. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. That was one of the specific things that the colonists complained about. And then in the very next particular, he has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices, the amount and payment of their salaries. If a judge made a ruling that the king didn't like, the judge's salary was either abolished entirely or reduced. Among the hundred or so listed things that the colonists had to complain about, these two particularly touch upon the idea of an independent judiciary. The judges were subject to the king. After the American Revolution, the colonies attempted to exist for a short period of time under the Articles of Confederation, which didn't work. They involved really only one branch of government, the legislative branch, but they had neither an executive nor an independent judiciary. When that failed, as you're aware, the Constitutional Convention met in Philadelphia and produced the remarkable document under which all of us still serve, the Constitution of the United States. That Constitution provided for an independent judiciary in Article 3. It specifically identified the judiciary in certain terms and then left to the Congress the opportunity, as you were granted the opportunity under amended Article 7, Section 3 of the Oregon Constitution, to establish other inferior courts and provide for their procedures and so on. But it also, the Constitution also contained a couple of other little notes which seem to be worth mentioning, at least in passing. The Constitution provided that in Article 6, sort of as an afterthought to everything else, this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Anything. Notwithstanding. And it's further provided in Article 6 that the senators and representatives before mentioned, those are the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation in support of this Constitution. In other words, we're all bound. And if you think about it, you wouldn't want it any other way. The idea was this. There has to be some kind of fundamental agreement that we've all entered into, some kind of fundamental deal that we've all made with ourselves, which establishes the central principles upon which we will operate our society. We are left with elbow room to do all kinds of things as we wish. But there are a few central matters that are set in here that we can't violate. This is the deal we made with ourselves. The obligation falls upon the members of the executive, the members of the legislative branch, and the member of the judiciary, all to obey that admonition, to stick with that fundamental deal and that fundamental principle. The distinction between the other two branches and the branch to which I have the privilege to belong lies in the degree to which we encounter the Constitution and its obligations. You, on a daily basis, encounter the Constitution because you carry out some of the functions that are described in it. In enacting legislation, you conduct a process which is spelled out in the Oregon Constitution and which is very similar to the one that's followed in the federal Constitution. In determining what measures to propose and in determining what measures to veto or to sign, the governor, again, carries out duties that are set out in the Constitution. In all of that, you have the opportunity to decide affirmatively what public policy shall be. And because you are members of a state legislature, the limitations upon you are very few. Unlike the federal constitution, which, because it was formed as an assent to the grant of power from 13 different independent states, unlike that constitution, which is supposed to describe limited powers for a limited government, you may have missed that lately, but in fact they're supposed to be limited. Because it describes that kind of government, the principles run one way, but with respect to state governments, and you are the inheritors directly of the original 13 colonies in this respect, with respect to state governments, you have all powers that the Constitution of the state does not specifically take away from you. You can legislate with respect to anything else you please. You are, in fact, subject to your own state constitution and to this document, but it doesn't say a lot about most of the things you might wish to legislate with respect to anyway. So your powers are, for all practical purposes, plenary. And you do this every day. This is the work you do. You exercise that constitutional power. What's left to us? What's our job? Every now and then, someone is upset by the choice you made. And that person finds himself or herself... Senator Walker says it's more than every now and then. And in fact, Oregon is one of the most litigious places in the known universe. But nonetheless, it is still every now and then. Individuals find themselves at odds over some choice that you have made. And they seek to resolve their dispute in the place that you have and that the people of this state have provided in their constitution for the resolution of such a dispute, in the courts. And it becomes then our responsibility as individual judges, or if a matter is appealed as groups of judges, to attempt to determine first what policy choice did you make, identify that specifically, and then determine if it's asserted that that policy choice is not permissible under the Constitution, and then determine whether in fact it is permissible or not. The presumption is always that it is permissible, so we have to find, if we're going to declare it unconstitutional, we have to affirmatively find that in some respect, the policy choice that you made flies in the face of some identifiable superior rule that exists in the Constitution. That's what we do for a living. We do not go look for trouble. Somebody has to bring the trouble to us. And to the extent they bring the trouble to us, we are then obliged. It is inescapable. We are obliged to decide the fight. This sometimes is interesting, sometimes even fun, occasionally amusing, and sometimes a true pain in the neck. But however we may feel about having to make the individual decisions, we have to make them. Under what guidelines? First of all, under the guidelines provided by the federal constitution and the state constitution, the words of those two documents we swore to uphold, and those are the words to which we look. I recognize that there may be members of this committee, there certainly may be members of the audience listening to me, who have the sense that instead of looking to those two documents, we simply identify within our own hearts and souls the way we think a particular dispute ought to come out, and that's the way we vote. If you really believe that, there's nothing I can do to change your mind. I can tell you bluntly that that is not so. It's not so in Oregon. It is so some other places with respect to some judges, because I know them. I've had the opportunity to sit down and talk with them, and I've been thunderstruck by the sources that they look to instead of their own constitutions to decide questions. But it is not true here. We have taken the oath seriously. Sometimes it's very difficult to carry out the oath because sometimes it's difficult to tell what constitutional provisions mean or are supposed to mean. Worse than that, the Oregon Constitution, which was drawn up by a committee in 1857 and approved by the people of the state of Oregon and then accepted by the Congress in 1859. The document is written in terms that were easy to understand 150 years ago, perhaps, but are tougher to understand now, both in terms of their absolute import and in terms of the spirit that those words may represent. It is our job to try to identify that spirit, whatever it is, and enforce it. Not change it, not alter it, not make it look like the kind of state we'd like Oregon to be if we happen to have a different view, but simply to identify it and enforce it. As it happens with respect to the Oregon Constitution, it's not even hard to change the document. If our interpretation turns out to be something that enough people dislike, heaven knows it's easy enough to put a measure on the ballot to change the Constitution. It is indeed, I submit respectfully, much too easy to do that. Because if the Constitution is supposed to be the fundamental deal we made with each other, it ought to kind of stay fundamental instead of so flexible that it changes every other Tuesday. But nonetheless, it's possible to make changes with respect to the choice we make. But for us, we are placed in a position where the dispute comes to us without our invitation. The arguments made by the parties and the claims they make under the state and federal constitution are brought without any prompting from us. And we have just one small task. Whatever they bring to us, we have to decide. This is, I will tell you, now that I've complained about it, as far as I'm concerned, the absolute best job that a person can have, because it forces you to read and to think and to study. It makes you write down your answers in a way which you hope will be clear to others and certainly must at least be clear to yourself. It represents the sort of challenge to an individual's intellect that makes public service worthwhile. Most of us who wear robes, most of us who are judges in the state system feel that way. There are certain to be a few who don't. But in the main, the men and women with whom I have had the honor to serve, and by now it's been a whole bunch of them over a period of, I'm in my 28th year as an appellate judge, the men and women with whom I have served have felt touched by the same honor and the same thrill of obligation that I feel. It is a privilege to do that work. There is no way around having every dispute under a constitution resolved by somebody. It could be resolved by the governor. It could be resolved by the legislature operating through some interesting committee process, but I think all of you can imagine what that would be like. Or it can be resolved by the judiciary. But one of the three branches must resolve it. It's not possible to continue to carry on the work of this state when there is a fundamental constitutional argument unresolved. Somebody has to decide. In the American system, based upon the American experience, we have chosen to leave that task to the judicial branch. And that's the task that the Chief Justice and I and our colleagues perform and hopefully will continue to perform, God willing. It's a task that we embrace. It's a task we hope to be able to explain to you in a way which will leave you with the following impression, I guess, about the way the judges work. You know, every now and then those guys make a decision that just makes me furious. I'm now speaking, impersonating a legislator, a dangerous move. But I would submit that a legislator will say that. But you know, I believe that they, however dumb that decision is for my internal value system, I believe that they reach the conclusion honorably and honestly. And in any event, I know that it is important that we obey it until we either change the Constitution or find some other way to deal with it. If we work that way, at least we find ourselves in a position where each one of us understands the task that the other has undertaken. Each one of us has, as certainly the members of the judiciary have for you, a respect for the work of the other branch. And even a sense of gratitude that we are not asked to perform the work that you do. You're asked to decide a whole series of public policy questions I'm profoundly grateful I don't have to address. But I would like you to believe that the Oregon judiciary takes its job seriously and its oath even more seriously. That our obligation to understand, to support, and to defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of this state lies at the heart of our very reason for existence. And I'd also like to think, if you stand back far enough and think about it, you wouldn't want it any other way. Senator Burdick, I'd be glad to yield to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Justice. My first question is, how many CLEs do we get for this presentation? My second question is, you point out that your job is to take what's put before you and decide it. And one of those ways that you can decide it is to decline to take a case from the Court of Appeals. And I just would find it interesting to hear your description of how you base those decisions on which cases to take for review and which not to.
As many members of the committee may be aware, Senator Burdick, members of the committee, as many of you may be aware, one of our limitations on jurisdiction is that we can choose which cases already decided by the Court of Appeals we wish to review. And the first limitation on that is one of the parties to the Court of Appeals decision has to be sufficiently unhappy with it to ask us to review it. And then it's up to us as a matter of discretion to decide whether or not to accept review in that case and to consider whether the Court of Appeals got it right or not. Believe it or not, there are circumstances in which a party unhappy with a Court of Appeals decision does not seek review. It doesn't happen very often, but at least it doesn't seem to me to, but in fact a lot of people do accept the outcome in the Court of Appeals. When they ask for review, we have published a series of criteria that are available to everyone, which describe the circumstances which are likely to lead us to seriously consider allowing review. And if you were to look at them, I'm sorry I don't have a copy with me, but I think we can see to it that you get a copy for the committee. It's in our Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure. When you look at the list, you'll discover that most of them appear to concern themselves with the general public interest in the case. Not public interest in the sense that the public enjoys reading about it, but public interest in the sense that the case has an impact beyond the individuals who are involved in that case. It's a case about, for instance, a statute which applies to a number of people, or a case about the constitutionality of a particular statute or a particular process or an administrative rule. It's a case of that sort. And we are particularly likely to allow review in cases of that specie in which review is sought from the Court of Appeals. We're also very interested in cases in which the Court of Appeals, which has 10 members, consider the case en banc. They normally hear a case with just 3 judges. Sometimes they then take the case en banc, all 10 of them consider it. If all 10 of them thought it was worth considering, we're very interested in that, too, because we trust the judgment of our colleagues, and if they think the case is that tough, there's a tendency for us to want to take such cases and take a look ourselves. And there are a number of other criteria that I'm forgetting at the moment.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Chief Justice Carson has, on a number of occasions, advocated for more resources at the trial court level to try to move things through. Is there a need for greater resources at the appellate level to help you do your work faster, more efficiently, or are you at the level of all you need is more time in the day and we can't give that to you?
The chief is now cringing because he's thinking, uh-oh, somebody else is being asked this question. Senator Ringel, members of the committee, everything is connected, everything else. It would be nice to have more time and more resources to work on the problems we face, but one of the biggest impediments to our doing our job is the fact that there aren't enough lawyers to present the cases that we need to hear, particularly on the public side, where the public defender and the attorney general's office are the two legal shops that are responsible for presenting the briefs on both sides. They don't have enough help yet to process the cases to us in a timely way. One of the things, you'll hear more about this from the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, my colleague David Brewer, but one of the things that drives them crazy and drives us crazy to a degree is the fact that neither the Appellate Division nor the Public Defender's Office has enough people to process their work in a timely way, and things get postponed and postponed and postponed. Could we use resources? The Chief will be speaking to that to you substantively later. But could the whole system use more resources? Yes. And if I may, Senator Ringo, just one more reminder, it's not an admonition, it is just a reminder. Every time you choose to make something else illegal, every time you choose to create a new legal procedure that didn't exist before, you have created a virtual guarantee that there will be appeals arising out of that process and out of those crimes. and that means there will need to be more prosecutors to prosecute them, more defense lawyers to defend them, more judges to try them, and more appellate judges to hear appeals from them. It is the inescapable consequence of perfectly logical and justifiable policy choices that you make. We can't, on our own, just say, well, we hereby declare an extra day because we got more appeals coming this week because the legislature created a really worthwhile new crime. The burden falls on all of us, the prosecutor, the police. I left them out. The police, the prosecutor, the defenders, the judges, both trial and appellate.
Thank you.
Other questions in the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mike.
Our next,
if I may, Madam Chair.
You can control the agenda here.
Well, only sort of. Let me now introduce three people that will try to, in a snapshot, put together how the system works. Most of you are familiar with it, very familiar with it. But first we have the Honorable Carson H. Rasmussen. He's a Lane County Circuit Judge, and some of you may remember he served in this body in the 1993 session. He came to the Circuit Court in 1999 and now is president of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association.
Welcome.
And then next to him is I'll get out of here. I'll return if you permit me. The Honorable Henry C. Breithaupt, Oregon Tax Court Judge. He was appointed in 2001 and then elected in 2002. And certainly a close friend of mine, the Oregon Court of Appeals, the Honorable David V. Brewer, who is the Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals. And some of you may know that he took over the job, I think it was 1 November last year, upon the retirement of Chief Judge Mary Dietz. And Judge Brewer was served on the Circuit Court from 1993 to 99 and joined the Court of Appeals in January of 1999. And I'll leave these gentlemen to respond.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Come on up. Welcome to all of you to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Burdick, and members of the committee. I'm Carsten Rasmussen. We've been told by the chief what order we're going to go in, and so we're going to go in that order today. I want to thank you for having us all here. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. You have a new pair of glasses, a sign of getting older, so if I take them off and put them on, it's because it's a new pair of glasses. I'm not sure whether I can read with them yet, but I'd like to be able to look at you as I go. I'm from Lane County, and I'm going to provide you with a brief overview of the trial courts in the state, with a particular emphasis on the circuit courts. Oregon circuit courts are authorized by statute, but provided and created by statute. Oregon is divided into 27 judicial districts, which are also created by statute. Most districts, such as mine in Lane County, which is the second judicial district, are made up of a single county, although that is not always true. In your materials at section 1, page 4, you'll see a breakdown and a map showing you the state. Oregon has 169 circuit judges, not counting senior judges. Senior judges provide service to the judicial branch after retirement. Naturally, the number of judges varies widely by judicial district. By way of example, Multnomah County has 38 circuit judges, Blaine County has 15 circuit judges, and Baker County has 1 circuit judge. Some counties use referees to augment the number of circuit judges. And judges, as you know, at all the state levels are elected officials who serve 6-year terms. The circuit courts are the state's trial courts of general jurisdiction. General jurisdiction means that the circuit court is authorized to adjudicate any kind of case regardless of subject matter, except those cases they are prohibited by law from adjudicating. For example, a statute grants the Land Use Board of Appeals exclusive jurisdiction in most land use disputes, and the Workers' Compensation Board has exclusive jurisdiction to resolve workers' compensation disputes. In both of these examples, while the circuit court has no jurisdiction, the Court of Appeals does have jurisdiction to review the decisions of these boards. Courts of general jurisdiction differ from courts of limited jurisdiction, such as federal, municipal justice, or tribal courts, which may adjudicate only those cases They are specifically authorized to adjudicate, usually by statute, sometimes by the Constitution. The Oregon Tax Court, about which you'll hear in a moment, is an example also of a court of limited jurisdiction. The circuit courts provide the state's primary forum for the resolution of disputes between private parties and businesses, for the enforcement of criminal law, and for the peaceful resolution of disputes which directly affect child and family welfare. Cases at the circuit court level are disposed of in a number of ways: by voluntary settlement, hearing, trial, court-sponsored settlement conferences, changes of plea and sentencing, or some form of administrative dismissal, to name the most common. I have noted this variety of dispute resolution forms because while the popular image is of a judge sitting on the bench during jury trial, the reality is that a trial judge's work encompasses many things, including jury trials, non-jury or bench trials, show cause hearings, probation violation hearings, probation review hearings, changes of pleas, sentencings, civil motion arguments, which is a form of hearing, criminal motions, arraignments on criminal charges, and more, including an occasional visit to the Legislative Assembly. Section 3, page 1 of the materials shows the number of statewide filings in circuit courts from 1993 to 2003. And to quote the Chief Justice, the heavy lifting of the Oregon judicial branch is done mostly at the circuit court level. In 2003, there were 655,574 filings in the circuit courts of Oregon. By my calculations, well over 99% of those cases are resolved fully and finally at the circuit court level without recourse to appellate courts. Of the disputes brought to, by way of example, to the circuit court of Wayne County, 99.7% of criminal cases and 97% of civil cases are resolved within 1 year of filing. We run a tight ship, and of course we have to, because the certainty of a trial date is often the major factor, certainly one of the major factors in forcing the parties to resolve a dispute. While Oregon's state courts are lumped together for administrative and budgetary reasons, the reality is that circuit courts operate quite differently and have a number of different emphases than appellate courts. As you can see from the materials, our volume is often volume work. In any given year, we handle small claims cases, and I'd reference you now to Section 2, page 7. There's a little organizational, why courts matter chart there. In any given year, we handle small claims court cases, landlord-tenant disputes, traffic cases, domestic relations matters, including child custody and parenting time disputes, as well as the disposition of marital property, paternity cases, termination of parental rights cases, construction disputes, probate matters, personal injury claims, adoptions, civil commitments, property disputes, Family Abuse Prevention Act hearings, stalking hearings, juvenile matters, business disputes, other civil disputes, breach of contract cases, collection matters, construction claims, many thousands of criminal cases, violations, misdemeanors, and felonies. In fact, as I noted earlier, we handled something in the order of 655,000 of those in 2003. The day-to-day work of your 169 state circuit judges ensures that the laws adopted by the legislature are fairly and timely applied, consistent with the intent of the Legislative Assembly. In addition to our many in-court duties, circuit judges routinely attend meetings in other governmental units such as public safety coordinating councils, domestic violence councils, and treatment providers. For example, in Wayne County, the circuit court, in cooperation with the sheriff and the Wayne County Office of Parole and Probation, has, through a new supervisory authority team, established a new center designed to create a seamless system of supervision and punishment for criminal defendants. This cutting-edge program has made some profound changes in the way that we handle the people's work in Wayne County. And I should also note that many of my colleagues on the circuit bench, as well as on other state benches, are routinely involved in our communities in many other ways as well. In sum, the work of the circuit courts and the circuit judges of Oregon is directly related to the personal, family, and business health and safety of our communities. I gathered some statistics regarding appeal from Wayne County. just to give you an idea of the kind of work we do and how much of it goes up on appeal. And rather than give you all those numbers, I would tell you this, that the numbers of appeals filed in the 3 years I looked at, 1998, 1999, and 2000, constituted less than 1% of the total filings in Lane County. And in those cases, in 1999, there was an appellate decision which reversed the Lane County Circuit Judge. In 1998, it was 7 reversals, and in 2000, 9 reversals. I worked out the math, although, unfortunately, I don't have my younger sister here, who was really the math student in my family, but I get something in the order of 0.03% of the time is a final decision of a circuit judge in Lane County overturned on appeal by the Court of Appeals. I will note, and I think it's important to note in these times, namely in times of Blakely decisions and their progeny, that that number will probably change because we're in a time of something of a sea change in terms of criminal sentencing, and so I would expect those numbers will change. But I bring you those statistics because I think it's important that you remember that the overwhelming majority of circuit court work, if you define, or the overwhelming majority of judicial work, if judicial work is defined as individual dispute resolution and public safety of this state, is done wholly at the circuit court level. Now, of course, judicial work is not defined solely as individual dispute resolution and public safety, so it is important to note that I don't intend to minimize the importance of appellate courts in our state, since it is the appellate courts who generally interpret the law. Within circuit courts exist a number of specialty courts, juvenile courts, probate court, drug court, family court, to name some. Not every judicial district has each of these. These courts have been created over the years to deal with particular areas of concern, and the use of these specialty courts varies by county. Again, by way of example only, we've had a drug court in Lane County for over 10 years, but we don't have a formal family law court. In addition to circuit courts, a number of other courts exist in Oregon. Most of these courts are creations of cities, such as municipal courts, or counties, such as justice courts. These courts have some amount of concurrent jurisdiction with circuit courts. For example, traffic matters and misdemeanor criminal matters may be filed in these courts so long as certain requirements are met. Appeal from decisions in these municipal or justice courts may be made to the circuit courts. Such an appeal is heard de novo, meaning from the beginning. Municipal and justice courts are not courts of record. In other words, they don't create a record suitable for review by an appellate court, and obviously circuit courts do. Oregon is also naturally a part of the federal court system. The U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon is a federal trial court made up of 6 district court judges, 5 senior judges who carry a small active caseload, 7 magistrate judges, and 5 bankruptcy judges. The District of Oregon is part of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. The differences between state and federal courts are significant, and by way of one example only, in 2004 there were 2,445 civil filings and 726 criminal filings in the U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon. I do not know, and could find out if it's important to you, whether that includes Social Security review filings, habeas filings, etc. 9 tribes in Oregon have developed tribal courts, and some have also established courts of appeal. Tribal courts have jurisdiction over cases involving tribal members and tribal entities. These courts may rely on state and federal law to resolve disputes in addition to the tribe's own constitution and laws. For example, last year the Coquille, or I believe now called Coquille, Indian Tribal Court in North Bend litigated an employment dispute between a tribe member and the tribe's police department. These cases involved breach of fiduciary duty, breach of tribal constitutional rights, and a violation of the Indian Civil Rights Act of 1968. Last, with respect to other courts, we hear occasionally about so-called constitutional or common law courts, which, as I'm sure you know, do not exist under either the Oregon Constitution or under Oregon statutes. These are extra legal courts which occasionally tie up the legitimate courts of the state. In a moment, Judge Brewer will discuss appellate courts and will, I think, to some extent contrast what a trial court does with what appellate courts do. There are some very important distinctions in both purpose and form. Trial courts sit individually. appellate courts sit in panels. My one vote is enough to decide an issue. Judge Brewer's is not, and I'm fond of saying I kind of like it that way. Circuit courts generally do not finally decide questions of statutory interpretation. However, to echo what Judge Gillette said a moment ago, on the whole, the similarities of trial courts and appellate courts are greatly outweigh any differences. All judges are committed to the rule of law, and most of the law that governs what we do on a daily basis is statutory, that is to say, it is made here by you. While I regularly consult appellate case law, much of that case law deals with how to construe a statute. Circuit courts are bound by the decisions of the appellate courts, which serve the important function of providing a well-established body of case law that interprets both statutes and the Constitution. The Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court thereby provide guidance and direction not only to the circuit judges of the state, but also to the citizens of the state and their attorneys in order that the citizenry may plan their lives and their business decisions in accordance with the law. As for circuit judges, we are content to make decisions about the individual disputes that are brought to us on a daily basis. I want to thank you again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for your time. I'd be happy to answer questions now or after my colleagues make their presentations.
We'll take one short round of questions now, because I had a question that applies specifically to the circuit courts, and that is, we're going to be struggling in this committee with the impact of the Blakely decision on our sentencing guidelines, but we don't yet have any statutory guidance for that. So my question to you is, how are you responding to the Blakely case in circuit court, if at all?
Well, there are a number of questions, I think, that are confronting circuit judges at this point regarding Blakely. There is no statutory direction for us. There is no case law direction from appellate courts in Oregon. There's some question remains about how does the issue come before us. There's a statutory remedy regarding correcting a judgment, which a number of us have ruled does not apply. So what's the manner in which the case comes to us? Is there a retroactive effect with Blakely? These are all unanswered questions, and actually are a pretty good example of why, if you had 169 different ways of doing it, the system wouldn't work very well. Eventually, we're going to get, I hope, direction from both the legislature and the appellate courts, and that will tell us how to do it on a uniform basis. In the meantime, there is some disparity in how it's being handled, and those cases are working their way up on appeal, and we will get some guidance from the appellate courts, I'm sure, relatively soon.
And the other quick question I had, just very briefly, is, and I know this is a long question that I'm going to ask you to compress, but you mentioned you had had drug courts in Lane County for 10 years, and that's a real hot spot for the meth epidemic. And what kind of impact on your drug courts have you seen from the methamphetamine epidemic?
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, we're very supportive in Lane County of the drug court system. It's, in truth, a difficult thing to measure outcomes in the drug court world, but it seems rather axiomatic, and I know that where my colleague Judge Larson here, he would tell you that if you don't deal with the people who are in drug court immediately, and if you don't get them into treatment immediately, then they will be lost not only to themselves, but to the rest of the criminal justice system, and more easily come back into the system later. The key to drug court in Lane County, I think it would be safe to say, is that it works quickly, and it works both in terms of the court getting a handle on the person quickly and the person in the treatment quickly, and then provides an immediate kind of judicial supervision of what the drug court defendant is doing. Judge Larson would be happy to go on about that at some length. He's been doing it for a number of years and is a big supporter of drug court.
You'll probably get a chance.
Just to echo something that was said a little bit ago about the impacts that you have here. It's not just prosecutors, it's not just police officers, it's jailbed space, which we have a shortage of in Lane County, in my view. Not a view shared by everyone, but that's my view. And that has an impact on how effective drug courts are. So, everything is I think in the popular parlance, hydraulic, it has an impact everywhere else when you try to tweak the system in one place.
Thank you. Are there other questions before we move on? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. During the budget cuts of, I think it was last biennium, some counties shut down their small claims courts. To your knowledge, are all counties running small claim courts now?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, to my knowledge, yes, and I believe have been for quite some time. I'm sorry.
Just to follow up, Manager. I mean, do you think, at least in your experience, that the small claims court system works well? Does the amount at issue need to be increased so that more claims can be included? Would you tweak it at all?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, you know, I would be happy to get you a better answer than any answer I could give you because, frankly, I don't do a lot of the small claims work. I think, by and large, it works well. In Lane County, we have a mediation program. We rely on that program a lot because a lot of people come into small claims court without an understanding of you know, whether they've really got a contractual a dispute or not, and you can often get those cases to resolve. And the mediation process, particularly in small claims court, when people are not represented, is a very good process, and we rely on it heavily in Lane County.
Thank you.
Thank you. More questions? Thank you. Now for our mysterious tax court, Mr. Breithaupt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm happy to be here today. My name is Henry Breithaupt, and I am the judge of the Oregon Tax Court. My colleague's mentioning about his glasses reminds me of something I heard earlier today on the radio. Today is the birthday of Benjamin Franklin, who got so tired of taking his glasses on and off to deal with different means that he invented the bifocal. So I'll put mine on from time to time and remember Benjamin Franklin. Judge Rasmussen mentioned that much of what he does derives from or involves the statutes that this body produces. I think it's fair to say that all that I do, all that the tax court deals with, is statutory. And not surprisingly, our Constitution in Oregon, Article 1, Section 32, provides that no tax shall be imposed except by the consent of the people or their representatives. And so, to echo what Justice Gillette said, that's the deal. The deal is people don't pay taxes unless this body or a coordinate branch, if you will, at the county level or city level, unless a legislative body provides that they shall pay the tax. But as you might guess, even when you believe you've been clear about what tax liability should exist, there can be disputes. Individuals, corporations, partnerships, trusts may have a question about just how much tax is owed or whether an exemption is available or some other question. And that kind of question prior to 1961 was resolved by, first of all, some level of administrative hearing at either the Department of Revenue or the County Board of Equalization, for example. And then the matter went to the circuit court where the taxpayer or the property was located, which meant that on any given dispute, it might be decided in Umatilla County one year and a similar dispute decided in Coos County the next year. Oregon was the first state in the Union to recognize at the state level that that system was not the best and to adopt by statute to create a specialized tax court, which was done in 1961. The court is a trial-level court. That is, the work I do is in many ways the equivalent of what Judge Rasmussen does. Our job is to create a record, at least at the regular division, and to decide the case. We do, as Judge Rasmussen mentioned, have limited jurisdiction, that is, to decide tax matters, and in particularly matters arising under the tax laws of the state. So if there is a dispute regarding a county tax, unless that county has made an arrangement with the Department of Revenue to collect the tax, those disputes do not come to the tax court but work through the regular circuit court system. The taxes that the tax court sees on a regular basis include personal income tax, property tax, corporate excise tax, timber tax, cigarette tax, local budget law issues, and property tax limitations under the state constitution. This body in 1995, together with the House, created a special division of the tax court called the Magistrate Division. So that now, if you think about the Oregon Tax Court, if you think about it in two divisions, one, the Magistrate Division, currently with five magistrates, and the other, the regular division, on which I serve. The thought was, I believe, that the first level of dispute resolution, when a citizen had a problem with a tax imposition, before 1997, that person went to the Department of Revenue, and there was a hearing inside the Department of Revenue. The legislature decided this first hearing, it would be better, or at least we should see if it was better, to move that first hearing out of the administrative agency, the Department of Revenue, and over to the judicial branch of government. And so the Magistrate Division was created in 1997 and has been functioning since September 1 of that year. In both the regular and the Magistrate Division, there is no jury. So I am perhaps the only judge in the state of Oregon that is not concerned about the Blakely decision. But I commiserate with those of my colleagues who do have to deal with that issue. The Magistrate Division, of which I spoke earlier, is currently comprised of five magistrates. That is the place that tax appeals are first heard as a general rule. The filing fee there is $25 with a $10 filing fee for so-called small claims cases. The procedures that are followed in the Magistrate Division are less formal than those followed in the regular division. For example, the rules of procedure and evidence that are more strictly followed in the regular division do not have to be followed in the Magistrate Division. The Magistrate Division has both a formal and, I think more importantly, a very informal method of alternative dispute resolution that has been very successful. I think although I've gathered no statistics on this, I think I've heard enough from the magistrates to tell you, and perhaps you won't find this to be a surprise, in many cases where a citizen is angry or upset or concerned about a tax matter, there has been inadequate communication between the taxing agency and the citizen. And when the matter comes to the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court, what happens is that a neutral third party called a magistrate sets up usually a telephone conference, not even in person, sets up a telephone conference, and in effect plays moderator for perhaps the first discussion between the government and the citizen. And in a surprising and, I think, pleasant number of cases, or it's a pleasant statistic, that first moderated discussion leads to an understanding and a clarification. And we find that many of the cases that come to the court with the use of a little bit of hand-holding and a little bit of explanation, those cases are resolved satisfactorily without going any further. In that sense, the Magistrate Division, I think, has met the expectations that the legislature had for it. Where those matters are not disposed of, then they proceed through a process that looks very much like the regular division, and importantly, all of the decisions reached by the magistrates are decisions in writing and are what are referred to as reasoned decisions. That is, it isn't just taxpayer wins or taxpayer loses, it's taxpayer wins and here is why. So there is an explanation to all parties of the reasoning that the magistrate followed. In all cases except those handled in small claims, if either party is dissatisfied with what the magistrate did, that party can, for the price of $50, appeal to the regular division where I hear the case de novo, again, meaning from the start. Basically, erase the blackboard. All I have is I have the decision of the magistrate for information purposes only, and I have a complaint from the party that's dissatisfied, and we start a proceeding. Now, the difference is that when I start a proceeding, I'm now starting that and going to complete, if that proceeding is completed, it's going to be completed with a record, perhaps produced on a system similar to the one you use here, a digital recording system. We are going to follow the rules of evidence. I'm going to build a record and render a decision in writing. And if either party is dissatisfied with that decision, either party may appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court, which will look at the record that's been created in the decision that I reached and determine whether there is sufficient evidence to support factual findings and whether I
applied the law.
The one thing that is important, I suppose, to note is that the appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court has, from the very beginning in 1961, been an appeal as of right. That is, the question that, Madam Chairman, that you asked earlier regarding the criteria by which the Supreme Court determines which cases to take from the Court of Appeals for review, that does not apply to tax cases. The case comes to the Oregon Tax Court, and if there is an appeal, it is directly to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court must hear it. The length of their decisions varies from quite long to quite short, but they do hear all of those appeals, and currently, under the statutes that exist, there's no discretion for the court in that regard. I believe that gives you a picture of the tax court as it operates. I should say one other thing. When our resources allow, we are a statewide court with statewide jurisdiction, that is, as opposed to the old system where it went to the local circuit. And the magistrates and the judge travel to the counties, if you will, where the matters have arisen, where it is appropriate, and especially where it can save taxpayers and their lawyers and witnesses the obligation of coming to Salem. But generally, the court sits in Salem. And I would now be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you. Judge Brewer.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Good afternoon to you and members of the committee. I'd like to begin, Senator Burdick, by thanking you and the committee for your commitment to collaboration between our respective branches of government. We look forward to working with you in other settings during this session, including upcoming educational programs for both houses and your visit next month to our court. My purpose today is to provide you with a more basic introduction to the place and function of my court, the Court of Appeals, within the judicial branch, and to answer any questions you may have about our role and operation. First, the basics. We're a 10-judge court that is elected statewide. With the exception of a limited number of appeals that go directly to the Supreme Court, you've heard about some of them, most notably death penalty cases, lawyer discipline matters, and tax court cases from Judge Breithoff's court, we receive every appeal filed from the state's trial courts and administrative agencies. The citizens of Oregon have an unqualified right to appeal those decisions to our court, and our doors are open to them. As you've already heard, if a litigant is unhappy with a decision made by our court, he or she may seek review before the Supreme Court, which has discretion whether to accept review. The Chief Justice can correct me if I'm mistaken, but I believe that the Supreme Court reviews from year to year on average from 4% to 6% of our decisions. As we speak, there are 9 sitting members of our court. The 10th position is vacant as the result of the retirement last November of my predecessor as Chief Judge, Mary Dietz. That vacancy will be filled within the next few months by gubernatorial appointment. The Oregon State Bar is currently fulfilling its function of providing public input into the appointment process by investigating the backgrounds and qualifications of the 18 candidates who have applied for the vacancy. The Bar will finish its work by early February and will then report its recommendations to the governor. In the meantime, we're sitting with 9 judges. It is important that our court operates at full strength. There are 36 intermediate appellate courts in the United States, and we generally rank first or second among those or any other appellate court in the nation in terms of workload. Whether we measure the number of cases filed per citizen or the number of cases filed per judge, from year to year, we are one of the busiest courts in the nation. Over the last 10 years, we've averaged about 4,000 appeals filed per year in our court. For that reason, our working model always must follow 2 goals that we can't compromise. We must decide cases quickly, and we must also do everything that we can to decide them correctly. Over the years, our case mix and volume have been fairly steady, subject to three notable exceptions. First, we often have an increase in appeals after the end of a legislative session, where the meaning of new statutes is questioned. Last session, for example, the Judgments Bill, HB 2646, comprehensively overhauled the form and content of trial court judgments in Oregon. We had about a dozen appeals in the aftermath of its passage that presented legal issues of first impression regarding its meaning. We've had to decide those cases quickly so that the trial bench and bar would have certainty on how to structure their judgments. Second, as you've heard, our workload can be affected by decisions made by the federal courts. As you know, over the past 3 years, the United States Supreme Court has greatly complicated sentencing in Oregon's felony criminal cases with its Apprendi, Blakely, and last week, Booker decisions. Those decisions arise under the federal Constitution, and as Justice Gillette has told you, of course, Oregon's courts are required to follow them. In those cases, as it often does, the United States Supreme Court has spoken in broad detail only, but left many issues unclear. As a result, there has been an increased volume of criminal appeals in Oregon that have required a prompt response from our court and the Supreme Court to answer for the trial courts and lawyers numerous sentencing issues on which the U.S. Supreme Court has cast legal doubt. As of this week, our court has decided 6 Blakely cases in the last 4 months. The Supreme Court also has decided State versus Diltz, round 2, in the last month. And we are continuing to work on additional issues on a weekly basis. We've assigned a special panel to address Blakely issues. We're expecting 2 more decisions to issue in the next few weeks. When cases like Blakely are decided, we have no choice but to divert state court resources to decide the unclear issues in order to protect the integrity of our criminal justice system here in Oregon. A third exception to caseload stability arose from the indigent defense budget shortfall during the last part of the 2001-03 biennium. Because the trial courts in Oregon were not able to appoint counsel in criminal cases during that period, our number in our court of criminal appeals fell in 2003 to approximately 1,200. As those cases were processed, however, our criminal appeal numbers have increased in 2004. So we've seen that that number increase as more cases are being processed in the trial court level. So as you can see, funding issues also can create some instability in appellate case volumes and a mix of cases. To meet the demands of its workload, our court sits in regular panels of 3 judges. Each panel has a presiding judge and 2 additional members. Each panel hears cases on average 3 sitting days per month. Between 12 and 30 cases are argued or submitted to a panel for decision without argument each sitting day. We also schedule a 4th panel each month to hear fast-track cases to which we give priority by statute. Chief among those case types are juvenile dependency, termination of parental rights, and land use appeals. Cases are assigned at random to each panel for argument and decision. We call that the wheel approach to make sure that no one panel gets more than its fair share of any particular case type. You should also perhaps be interested in knowing that our judges do come from many different kinds of backgrounds. Some of us, like myself, were trial judges, some were government lawyers, and others came from private practice. However, we each regularly sit on all of the varied types of cases that fall within the Court of Appeals jurisdiction. Before oral argument, each judge on the panel reads all the legal briefs that are filed in the cases, and each panel member participates in the argument. In that respect, Oregon is quite different from a number of jurisdictions, including the federal Ninth Circuit, where the judges haven't read the briefs before oral argument and instead rely on bench memos from their clerks. We don't believe that that's the way we want to do our business, so each of our judges has read all the briefs and is familiar with the facts and law in the case before argument. At the beginning and end of each argument session, the judges meet to discuss the issues in the cases. After argument, the presiding judge of the panel assigns cases among the 3 judges for the preparation of written opinions. Each of our judges is working on approximately 25 to 30 cases for written opinion at one time. After an opinion is drafted, the judges on the panel meet in conference and vote on the draft. Each department holds a conference twice each month to consider opinion drafts. At least 2 judges must agree with the panel opinion for the department to adopt it. A judge who disagrees may file a dissenting opinion. And if a majority of the entire court believes that a panel decision is incorrect, the full court can take the case for decision. We meet in full court conference once per month, and over the course of a year, we consider about 5% of our cases in full court. The full court conference model helps assure that our decisions are internally inconsistent, since we generally decide cases in panel, and that's critical to the operation of a large and busy appellate court. Since the mid-1980s, our court has steadily and substantially reduced its backlog of cases. Today, once a case is submitted for decision, a written decision generally is published within 3 to 4 months. In addition, it usually takes no more than 90 days to schedule a case for oral argument after it is fully briefed. I checked before coming here today, and at present we have only 5 cases that have been under advisement for 12 months or more. In each of those cases, consideration is being made by the full court, the opinion is close to publication, and because of the difficulties of the issues presented, it will probably have at least one concurring or dissenting opinion. Our greatest concern for timeliness in our court relates to an extensive motion practice in our pending cases. Incredibly, our court decides about 1,500 motions every month. Although most motions are not difficult, some are very complex and take a considerable amount of time to resolve. Among those are motions for summary affirmance in criminal cases, challenges to appellate jurisdiction, motions to stay the effect of a trial court or agency decision during an appeal, and motions for leave to proceed in prisoner appeals from parole board decisions. Many of those motions involve important constitutional issues and questions of statutory construction. To properly address them and keep our docket moving, 3 of our judges are members of a separate motions panel that meets once per month to decide complex motions. In addition, throughout each month, the motion judges and the chief judge individually decide reams of motions. Each of the motion judges also is a member of a regular court panel and therefore juggles multiple dockets. Motions work, along with much of the other reading and writing we do, is night and weekend work for our court. But if we don't stay on top of our motions docket, we can't timely decide our cases. For that reason, we have frequently front-loaded judicial time to decide motions that otherwise would have been devoted to decisions on the merits of the case. Make no mistake, this is not a complaint, because we all love the work we do and are grateful for the privilege of serving on the court. It's merely an observation regarding barriers to the most efficient resolution of appeals. I'd like to briefly mention 2 programs that we've adopted to carry forward our mission. The first is our appellate settlement program. You've heard a little bit about appropriate dispute resolution so far, and I can tell you that I spent 6 years on the Lane County Circuit Court bench. 2 of those I volunteered for and did the specialty docket for small claims. And I can tell you that the mediation work that was done at grassroots level in those small claims cases was wonderful. It was a pleasure to be involved. It's given me a special interest in appropriate dispute resolution as a way of saving time and reducing judicial backlogs. So we have one of those programs in the appellate court. Each year, the Court of Appeals is able to settle 150 to 200 civil, domestic relations, and workers' compensation appeals through the use of this mediation program. The cases are carefully screened, and those that participate, our settlement rate, 70% in 2004, is among the highest in the nation. And the feedback from the participants is positive. As you might expect, it's much harder to settle a case on appeal than it is before the trial court, because at the point of appeal, you've already got a judicial decision at the trial court level, and that creates its own momentum. I know this firsthand from my background as a trial judge, but whether at trial or on appeal, a settled case, one that the parties have crafted themselves with the assistance of a mediator, rather than had imposed by a court, is often best accepted and enforced. As a firm believer in voluntary, and I repeat and emphasize the word voluntary, judicial mediation programs on appeal, I can assure you that this program helps engender public trust and helps us decide our remaining cases more expeditiously. The second court program I'll briefly mention is one that the Supreme Court initiated several years ago, but which we have also adopted. As you know, it's not uncommon for students in high schools today to receive little government or civics education. We recognize our role as a statewide court, and we believe in making the court's work accessible and understandable to the public. To perform a role in community education, our court regularly sits in schools throughout the state, holding oral argument, talking to students and community groups about the importance of the rule of law and how our government works. To further that mission, during the next 6 months, we will hold court sessions in public high schools in McMinnville, Roseburg, Bend, Hood River, Canby, and Pendleton. And we'd ask you and invite you, if you would like to schedule a court session for the Court of Appeals in your community, we'd be happy to oblige. I'd like to say one brief word about priorities and decision-making in the appellate courts. As you will see in the written materials that we've provided, the legislature has given the appellate courts various priorities by case type for purposes of deciding our cases. In addition, we all have a concern about finding a way to quickly decide non-meritorious appeals. My only cautionary note is that each statutory modification of priorities always affects our ability, given the same resource base, to decide other cases, sort of like Newton's Law. Your ongoing sensitivity to that point as you perform your work this session is much appreciated. Finally, as a statewide court that decides cases in a group decision-making model, our judges and staff assemble each day in the same building, right across the mall from you, on the same floor, to do our work. We find that having regular personal access to each other and our staff is critical to the work of an effective court. In the same vein, we look forward to getting better acquainted with each of you over the next months as colleagues who collaboratively perform the people's work. And we pledge any assistance that we can offer you in your education and other programs. And with that, I'm pleased to answer any questions you may have. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I want to commend you for getting out to the state. I know we're in the process of doing that ourselves in the Senate. It's not an easy thing to do, but I think it's very valuable. And also for the committee, we are working with the House committee to go actually observe one of the Blakely-related cases that you have pending. I hope we can get that scheduling together.
We look forward to that. Thank you.
So I really appreciate the work you do. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're at the final act of our presentation. Again, for the record, I'm Wally Carson. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. Most of you know, but let me point out two things. I run, like the other six of my colleagues, every 6 years for a term on the Oregon Supreme Court. And thank you, Dale. And then the court itself elects the Chief Justice for a six-year term. They're not coterminous. It's just Bud Lent stepped down in September, and Ed Peterson came in, and then he stepped down in September, and I came in September, so my term is 6 years, September to September. And as that, I am the presiding judge of the Supreme Court, so I handle the administrative matters within the court, much as Judge Brewer, as chief judge, handles the Court of Appeals, and we have presiding judges in each of the 27 districts as well. Another function I have, since the state takeover of the trial courts and the employees in the various counties, is as the chief administrative head of the Oregon Judicial Department. And that consumes a large part of what I do. So I have three judges, I'm a three responsibilities, associate justice or justice, presiding judge of the Supreme Court, and chief administrative head. Now, I'm going to give you a quick review, and if you need more comment, I'll respond to questions, of course. If you, the question has come up on petitions for review. The Court of Appeals was initially created in 1969 by this body and your colleagues across the, former colleagues across the rotunda, and by 1977 it reached its full 10-member panel or 10-member court. At that time it was designed that all the cases, almost all the cases, would go to the Court of Appeals. And we would only have our original jurisdiction, which the Constitution gives us, and some selected cases that will go directly to the Oregon Supreme Court. Things have changed over time, and if you look to the third orange sheet or salmon sheet on tab 2, I think it is, tab 2, you'll see a list of several pages that give us the idea of mandated, we call them mandated, cases that come to the Supreme Court. That has changed. It used to be, I think it was contemplated, that about somewhere between 90 and 95% of the cases would be discretionary. Now somewhere around 50 to 55% are discretionary, and the rest of them we take whether we want to take them or not, because the legislature has seen fit to give us that responsibility, which is your responsibility. But we're no longer a discretionary court, and so the petitions for review, assuming that the Court of Appeals has 4,000 cases, and they haven't been quite up that high in some time, but they're close to it, a huge caseload, less than 1,000 are petitioned to us for review, and so somewhere 20, 25% of the ones that go in the front door of the Court of Appeals come knocking at our door. And as Chief Judge Brewer mentioned, we run between 6 and 9% of the cases that we review, and it's, last year was 753 cases petitioned to us, and we review and write an internal memo in each of the cases. Then we meet, and decide what cases to allow under the criteria that I'll get you a copy of the ORAP, the Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure, that Justice Gillette spoke to. And then it only takes three judges to allow, one less than a majority of the court to allow, and it's set for argument, and then it's set for opinion and opinion issues. We do have some, the kinds of things that are come directly to us, as you know, are aggravated murder, death penalty, aggravated murder, ballot titles, and a whole group of citing cases and a variety of others that you have seen fit to go directly to the Supreme Court. Let me speak briefly. The state court administration is my responsibility, but the person that brings it all together is Kingsley Click, who is the state court administrator, and she's here, well experienced and a very capable person. And you can look at on the appellate court tab 5 has some more statistics for your a bedtime reading, or if you have attack of insomnia. Tab 6 is the part that relates to the administration of the court system. There's another wiring diagram that gives you some idea of the breadth of activities that the state court administrator performs for the court system. We are centralized in the sense that her office provides service to all the appellate courts and the tax court and all the trial courts. Madam Chair, you've been a patient audience, and we do very much appreciate your willingness to have us come and talk about what we do. I, like the others who have spoken, are thrilled and very pleased to have had the opportunity to serve our fellow Oregonians as Chief Justice and as a trial judge. That was a lot of fun, too. It's a wonderful opportunity to work with very good people, and I look forward to working with this group in the weeks ahead to work together for the benefit of Oregonians. And with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll shut up.
Thank you very much for coming. This has been a very helpful presentation. We really appreciate you taking the time, especially given your caseloads. Are there questions from the committee or comments? Senator Pozanski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had to step out before the last panel spoke, and so I'm not sure Judge Carson Rasmussen's addressed the body, but I want to just relate what he had told me. He asked me to make sure that everyone knew, because of his position, that if there's any of us who needed to have contact with their circuit court judges, that he would be one that would be willing to help facilitate that, and that he expects that the judges that serve in our communities would be more than willing to give us the insight as to how it, the rubber hits the road in their own communities, and that he understands that for many of us who are serving on the committee who may not have the legal background, that the judges would be willing to help us as best they can within their parameters.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up. I just wanted you to know that I've had wonderful offers of help from all of the levels of the court system in Oregon. I really appreciate it, and I will take advantage of it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman, and I'm pleased. In fact, later this month, you're going up to Multnomah County to have a hearing at the courthouse up there.
Yes, we are indeed.
And they're excited about you coming up there. And if I may piggyback on Senator Pozanski's, please call any judge. It's easier to call the presiding judge of the various counties, and I think those lists are in materials we've handed out, but we don't screen or censor our trial judges. So you can call anybody you want. It's risky, I grant you, but you can call anybody you want and get what they think about what I'm doing or not doing, as the case may be, or how the system is working. And you're certainly welcome to do that. They remind me constantly that they are independently elected judicial officers, and they'll follow when I'm going in the right direction and maybe not when they go in the other. Professor Lefevre once commented, it's like leading judges as other groups, it's like herding cats, and I've had that experience now for 15
plus years. We're also familiar
years.
With that.
I know. That's where I got my training, is working here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you. Chief Justice, I just wanted to say that I've been going to Klamath Falls for as long as I've been in court reporter, 21 years. I've been traveling with the bankruptcy court down there, and we used the courthouse, which when the earthquake happened, we were in all places but a courthouse. And I just want to tell you that the staff there is, as I have found them all around the state, the staff and the judges are just superb. We have a really good cross-section of our state and very intelligent, dedicated public servants, and they really enjoy having a state senator come down and visit them about court issues. So, and it's nice to have Senator Whitsett here, even though he stepped out for the moment from Klamath Falls, so I can help integrate him with his court folks, because they're actually already missing me. So, I just want to let you know that I'm familiar with their issues. They don't have court reporters there like many of our courtrooms across the state, but I have enjoyed speaking with them and learning what their concerns are.
Madam Chair and Senator Walker, that's very nice to hear, and I'll pass that on to them that you are laudatory. I like to think we do that in all 27 districts, but it's nice to hear. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Committee meeting is adjourned.
Gee.